Good evening. This is Module 18, the Heart Sutra, Talk 6, and the title of the talk is No Fear. And that is what we want to get to pretty quickly here.
Let's hope we get somewhere.
So we have time to talk about that, because that's a very important topic. We are going to end this module with one more session, and that will, Michael will be teaching that, and that will start with the mantra. So we want to get right up to where the mantra, just before the mantra today. And we don't need to really cover all of the territory all that much, and you don't need a lot of information to do it. So to begin with, I want to briefly tell of a, you can call it a story, whatever you want. And it was quite some time ago that I went to Providence, to the home of Zen Master Sun Sun, who I had the great privilege to meet, and I believe he is a very great realized Zen master. And I went to what is called a sesshin, which is a intensive practice period, which has pretty strict rules and no talking and all sorts of rather formal behavior. One of the things about a sesshin is that everyone gets to meet with the master for a brief interview. This interview is called a dokusan. And it is not a chit-chat, it's not an opportunity to ask how's your practice going. It is a very brief in, you get the point, out. And that's it. So I came in. I should say that some of his students are practicing koans. I was not. For one thing, I was too new, and for another thing, my root guru is Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, so he would not be my root guru. But in any case, he treated me somewhat like that. No koan, but I came in, and I sat down, he had a stopwatch on the table. It was ticking. And he said, "What is this?" Now if I say, "Oh, that's a stopwatch," that's taking things to be existent, truly real. If I said, "Well, it's really doesn't exist, it's just empty," that would be taking emptiness as an object. If I said, "Well, it's it seems to be somewhat real, but it's really marked by emptiness," that would be trying to have it both ways. And if I sat there in silence, that would be not wanting to have it no way. That is just refusing to play the game at all. What happened is I was trapped. I picked up the watch and just held it to my ear and listened to it ticking. And very grudgingly he said, "Not so bad, I want to see more." Okay, so the point of this is not to have any further discussion about form is emptiness is form is no other than form is no other than emptiness, but to point out that there is no logical position going on there at all, that the whole thing is designed to make sure that you can't figure it out. You have no choice but to open up and just be spontaneous, which is difficult. So that is about as much as I have to say about that particular topic, which we've talked about quite a bit, and if you want to talk about it next week, you can talk about it next week. But I'd like to touch on a few other really interesting things before we get to no fear. So one of them is page 113, Emptiness and Compassion. And I think we touched on this a little bit last week, but it's worth sort of repeating. So someone asked the question, the experience of ultimate reality, even if it is fleeting, happens spontaneously or instantly. So does compassion arise equally naturally along with that experience? In other words, does the experience of great compassion or care for all beings spring from the realization of emptiness? And he's not going to have it either way. So he says the realization of emptiness without compassion is impossible. You have to work on compassion too. It's not that we realize emptiness and all of a sudden we attain great compassion. We can't even realize the emptiness if we don't already work with compassion. And he says, compassion is often compared to the moistening quality of water. We read that last week, right? Mm-hmm. In that it moistens our mind's being, that makes, thus making it supple, flexible, and fertile. If we lack compassion, our mind is like some very old, dry piece of leather. It is very rigid and almost lifeless, no matter how much insight into emptiness we might have. If we have an overemphasis on the progeny of realizing emptiness, our mind can become like that stiff leather, or like a sharp sword which cuts very well but has no heart. That is why we speak of emptiness with the heart of compassion. And a little while later, I don't have it right in front of me, he goes on to say, so we need to do the relative work of compassion at the same time that we're trying to understand or not understand whatever it is about emptiness. And the relative work are things we've worked on in the past and we can go back to. They are the immeasurables or limitless ones. They are Lojong. They are the slogans. And in particular, there was one slogan he cited somewhere here. Can you recall what it was? It was about shunyata is the supreme emptiness. How's it going?
Seeing confusion as the fourth kaya is a supreme shunyata protection.
Okay, so we get that in our practice there. So thank you. There's another little thing which I thought was very interesting here. On page 114, there's a question. In order to directly perceive ultimate reality, is there anything to be transformed other than our conceptual mind? And this is a good question because we've been bang, bang, drop your conceptual mind, drop your conceptual mind. Is there anything else? And he says, yes, our conceptual mind is the most superficial level of all the layers of our mind that need to be transformed. And he goes right into all the other aspects which are deeper than that, and they have to do with consciousness and the eight types of consciousness and the samskaras or the mental factors, including the wholesome ones and the not-so-wholesome ones and so on, all of which we have talked about. But conceptual mind is what we notice first, because we've been sitting and we know, the first thing we know is that we have thoughts. So it's simply an excellent starting point into what will turn out to be layers and layers and layers of our mind going into our karma and all that juicy stuff. I thought that was interesting to point out. If anyone wants to comment on that, they are welcome.
The only comment I have is the question itself, which I felt Brunhilde didn't really make this point, but the very first phrase in the question doesn't make any sense, because it's not possible to perceive ultimate reality. And that's the premise of the question. That's a small side thing. I really shouldn't bring it up.
No, you can't bring it up.
I felt that Brunhilde should have called him, the questioner on this.
Okay, but he doesn't say the perception. He says the experience of ultimate
experience,
reality.
Experience, right.
Okay.
I don't believe it's possible to experience ultimate reality.
Depending on whether we take experience to mean what experience by...
I'm sorry, what... I have in the question, in order to directly perceive ultimate reality, do you have a different question?
On page 113?
Yeah, that was 114. That was the question that Peter was reading.
That's the one I was referring
to. Yeah, 114. In order to directly perceive ultimate reality, right. Is there anything to be transformed other than our conceptual mind?
It would seem to me that that's not possible, because that would, a perceiver and the perceived as being two separate things.
Mm-hmm. Create a duality, right?
Yeah, it would be a duality. It's kind of a small point. I really should make that.
No,
it's
okay.
Good to bring it up. It doesn't matter. Bring it up. It's good.
It's a good point.
That's a good point.
Mm-hmm. It's a perfectly fine point, yeah.
I'm more challenged by the word ultimate.
Yeah.
Do you want to say more about that?
I don't think so.
Versus mundane?
Versus everyone's perceived reality. I mean, two people look at the same thing and they see it differently. So what's the ultimate reality? Mm-hmm. It's just I'm challenged by the concept. It's not
well, especially when you put perceived in there.
Mm. Yeah, because that's the problem.
But the moment you put perceived in there, it's not,
everyone
it's
sees
not
it their own way.
That's
right. The individual, it that's separates right. it out.
I think that's a good point.
Mm-hmm. Very good point.
Okay, and your point is well taken. Brunhilde isn't necessarily challenging the question as it asks all the time, but if you want to challenge it, you're welcome to. Now I come to something very curious. I find it very curious. On page 117, you're all very familiar with this statement in the sutra itself. In the same way, feeling, discrimination, formation, and consciousness are emptiness. Which, having gone through the tetralemma, form is emptiness, so on, in the same way, feeling is emptiness is, he goes through all five of them. That's the intention in one very brief sentence. And Carl Brunhilde says, the following. The same principle can be applied to the other skandhas, such as the one of feeling. And then he says, which is probably by far the largest skandha of Western people, whereas it is quite small in the East. Now that's quite a challenging thing. You certainly aren't going to find a discussion of that in any Dharma text. And you may or may not agree with it. Before we agree with it, let's get clear what feeling is. It is the second skandha. It's not emotions. Emotions come all along later with the fourth and fifth skandha and the eight consciousnesses and the wholesome and unwholesome what are the terms there?
Actions or deeds?
No,
samskaras.
Formations, samskaras, formations, okay. But feeling is not that. It's simply a primitive thing. It's like, dislike, or ignore. Neutral. Only three choices. And he's saying that Westerners make a big deal of that, and it probably is not a big deal for, say, Tibetans or other people in the Orient. Does that make any sense?
No. I think what it means, my opinion on that is that Westerners are more likely to express their feelings very loudly and at the first opportunity. But I have trouble believing that reaction doesn't exist. I actually think it's cultural about what we say out loud. That is, of course, another opinion.
Right. So you're saying...
I think we're taught... how do you feel? How do you feel? Like our feelings are so important. You know, especially with kids now.
Remember, feel is like, dislike, or ignore. Mm-hmm. It's not emotion.
Okay, all right.
As an ego, as identification, we identify with what we like more than maybe other cultures do, that we define ourselves.
That way.
By
okay.
Our opinions more than maybe others do. That's just take.
Yeah, I have my rights. Right?
The individualist.
And if my rights are interfered with, I will protest. They will not be taken away from them. Me. I will. That's what's important to me. As opposed to
I think it's an overly broad statement.
Yeah, actually,
I don't think he really has good grounds for making that statement.
Yeah, I know that I had lunch in a Thai restaurant today, and a customer was giving a long lecture to the waitress about some errors in English grammar in the menu, and then said that he could provide the service of his Toastmasters Society, which is useful for people who are not good at speaking English. And the waitress sat there very, very polite, and I do not believe she didn't have any feelings about this customer. But she was, you know, the combination of being from a Thai culture and being in a service context, but I was seeing a lot of relatively subtle body language that I think the customer might have missed because he had a lot to communicate. Lexington, same difference.
I have to agree with that point as well, because in psychology it's a common term that just because you don't express your feelings doesn't mean you don't have them.
Are we talking about feelings meaning like?
I understand, judgment. It can be judgment. Just because you're not expressing your judgment of like or dislike doesn't mean that you don't have the like or dislike.
I think strictly speaking, though, the terms like and dislike and neutral, which are the Vedas, came right out of the Buddha's earliest sutras, and which is where? From the East, right?
Yeah.
And they were a very important part of, among other things, the 12 Nidanas, and also the 5 Skandhas, of course. And I think that they were considered by the Buddha himself to be very important, an important part of his teaching, that they give rise to the sankharas beyond that.
Oh, they do, yeah.
And they give rise to grasping and clinging and to aversion, and to make the statement that's not an important part of the Eastern psyche is, I don't know where he's getting that. That doesn't make sense to me. I'll just say.
Yeah.
Okay, it makes somewhat sense to me in that I would say that Easterners are used to the idea that they don't have power over governments or other institutions that can wipe them out, that are not fair and so on, that the sense of fairness and protest are thus developed there, and that they wouldn't spend their energy there. Hmm. That's about the only sense I can make of it.
Hmm. I also think in the East there's more collective thinking as opposed to individual thinking. So there, in my experience, it's not as much to make waves for yourself and put yourself forward. It's a collective process.
I did some research on the word honor, and it's very interesting to our perspective, a Western perspective, generally the word honor is an internal code, which actually is more in alignment of morality, as opposed to honor in the Eastern cultures is often more a reflection of ethics, which is an external code. So it's kind of in the line of what you're saying, which is that in cultures that have more of a collective approach, what we adhere to inside is more determined by the outside, the group, in Eastern cultures.
However, I'm sorry, but the first time I heard that distinction, it was shame versus guilt cultures, and that we are, and they actually talked about two different stages of Western culture as embodying those two, and that shame, you know, external versus internal forces. So the ancient Greeks were referred to as a shame culture, whereas modern culture is guilt. But I think that I just get very edgy with the words East and West, like where does the boundary? You know, modern India is not what you would call a calm and collective society. That's one of the most active, politically active and self-interested cultures there is. And I think that, you know, and India, I think, is traditionally part of the East. I just get very uncomfortable with any generalization that tries to draw a dividing line between two halves of the globe and to say that there's a fundamental difference in attitude as opposed to the expression of current circumstances. But
well, what I was saying was my experience with Asia and the people that I spent time with in Asia. So that's...
Okay, I think we've got a whole vastness of interesting psychological stuff, which we could go on forever, but I think there are interesting issues here. So I want to skip quite a bit, namely all the no's.
No no's.
There are a
no
lot
negativity.
Of them. No eye, no ear, no blah, 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 no this, no that, no everything. And finally, no wisdom, no attainment, and no non-attainment. And it seems to me that by saying no non-attainment, this is an admission that this list could be infinite. Because if there's no attainment and no non-attainment, then there could be no... neither attainment nor non-attainment. And if you're going to admit that, then you could admit something else, right? So I think the list of no's is infinite. Does that make
right.
sense?
Yes. It does. It's just a sample of a drop in the bucket.
Yep.
And haven't we already established that with the
first?
The four, the tetralemma, is that what you call
yeah.
it? I mean, we've already established that it's infinite with that.
Okay, well, that's unanswerable, and maybe you see unanswerable, it's infinite is the same. Okay. Anyway, we don't need to make more. So we don't need to make more lists, right? Like the 39 ways to distract yourself with a cell phone.
Only 39.
Right?
Yeah, I know.
Or the 217 ways to get upset about current events.
At least.
Just one.
That's all.
Yeah. I had a few zeros on that one. Meaning a zero. So I'm currently listening to some lectures by Khandra Rinpoche around egolessness.
Yeah.
And she put a great question to the whole group. Provide me with an example, a moment that you've experienced that was egoless. And people came up with all kinds of situations. And she deconstructed each and every one of them.
Oh, wow.
It was wonderful. She said something that I thought was really pithy. If any experience has a cause or condition or an action involved with it, it is not egoless.
Mm-hmm.
And So I know that there's a difference, however subtle, and I'd love to hear more around it, between egoless and emptiness, which is what this is about, right?
Yeah.
Can we put more words just around that difference?
Egolessness and emptiness?
What about the act of perception?
Yeah, is that a trick question? Because was it like if you answered with an example of egoless, then it was automatically not egoless? Like a trick question.
So I think it's because a lot of people in the audience were absolutely certain they've had egoless moments. And so I think she wanted to see where people's heads were on what they believed was the definition of egoless.
But what I'm asking is, from your understanding of it, would it be possible for somebody to express an experience that they felt was egoless, once you express it, would it not be egoless anymore?
I think it's kind of along those terms. Mm-hmm. You know, any situation that you give, like one woman said, looking into the eyes of her child for the first time, and she said, and she explained, absolutely that was interesting. This was really skillfully done. She explained, let's not take away from the fact that that is a very high level love. But it's not egoless. So egoless is a different state, because it is a child whose eyes you're looking into, you know, that's inspiring this feeling in you. So I got the idea that if you were standing in front of a mass murderer, would you have that same feeling, that unconditional compassion? If you were looking at a toad, would you feel that same? So, because my thought on it is really there's a subject and an object there. And the moment there's a subject and an object, it's not egoless. That's what I got out of it.
And she's sharpening your wisdom by making you realize this, right?
Yes.
By putting you through this process.
And it was people pulled into the next day and kept bringing up more exams. She has such patience.
So I have a question, Fanny. Did she provide something about egolessness? Or was it all no?
I think that's kind of the idea.
This is egolessness.
That's what the point is, I think.
Subject and object are both empty also.
What's that?
So we can take emptiness and apply it to anything, including ego. Ego is empty. Subject is empty. Object is empty. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Your question is, how do we differentiate between or further discern the distinction between egolessness and emptiness?
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that she manifested it herself? Not what she said, but...
Do I feel like she manifested egolessness?
Or emptiness, which is...
So as she was saying those things, I just kept coming back to the Heart Sutra. I didn't know if that was a correct analogy or correct connection. But the more she answered, and the more I heard people give situations, I could see that that wasn't an egoless moment, because it wasn't empty.
Well, it is empty. Everything is empty. There is nothing that is not empty.
Right.
The difference is egolessness. Projections are empty too. Emptiness is all pervasive. There's nothing that's not empty. I mean, it's really drastically, radically simple.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas egolessness is very specific.
Is there such a thing as egolessness? Or is it attainable?
Yeah. Egolessness refers to an absence of oneself as being somebody.
So it's a subset of emptiness?
No, everything is empty anyway. You could say egolessness is emptiness, just like everything is emptiness.
But emptiness
has a specific application. I mean, egolessness has a specific application.
Okay, so emptiness
is much bigger than egolessness.
Yeah.
Egolessness is specifically
a Venn diagram.
Yeah.
Okay.
So egolessness is more applying to self.
Yeah.
And emptiness
applies to everything.
The non-existence of self is different from the emptiness that is everything and nothing at the same time.
Okay.
But did you feel that she, not what she said, but that she manifested emptiness by her being there?
All I know is I thought she was a profound patient. I mean, seriously.
That's an aspect of it. But
She was given the same...
It was an audio tape, so she did.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Yeah, it was an audio.
It's an audio. Okay. I haven't been present with her for these. Yeah. So, yeah.
The way I've heard it put is there's emptiness of self and there's emptiness of other. Sort of two main categories of emptiness. And it would seem to me the inference of that would be that egolessness might be defined as emptiness of self and aware that myself is empty. Not just, yes, it's true, everything is empty. But if I don't know that I'm empty, then I'm going and acting in the world like an ego.
But it's still egoless because there's no real identity. The easiest way to understand egolessness is identitylessness. Ultimately, we can't find ego when we look for it, right? And it's an assignment of a particular notion that something exists and that it's real and it's unchanging. You know, that's why it moves into the particular notion of it. Eternalism, because it's this notion that something is kind of continuous and ongoing and impermanent. And so we can say egolessness of phenomena because we assign the notion that phenomena is real and we give it names and then we believe that the name is real and we believe that, you know, somehow those things that we label are real because we put the label on it instead of realizing the label is just a convenience we use, right? Is this making sense?
Don't you think the discussion of twofold egolessness would be helpful here? Now that I'm
sure.
stuff like
sure.
Why yes, Emily.
Okay, Emily, you're on a spot.
You have another concept I never understood. But okay, I'll try. So the way I understand it is you can there's 1.5-fold egolessness. That's an understanding of no self, like the skandhas, like how we put together I have my name, you know, the whole way we construct self. And the other piece is the emptiness of phenomena. So
what about the Pratika Buddha?
Well, I don't know.
You want to throw another one in there?
Don't get me confused. I'm having a hard time here. And so it's like everything out there that we consider solid, we can penetrate through that and understand that, you know, maybe beyond concept as empty. But then there's still someone figuring it out.
Right.
And that's the half. That's the other half. So cutting, that's why the sword has two sides. It cuts back sword against that other, the sword of Prajna, that other half of ego, which is the identifier of all the things happening. Yes.
Right.
So that's my understanding.
Yeah, because the idea of reifying phenomena is that it then reifies self.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And even in the Dharmakaya, we still have duality. Because once you have samsara, you have nirvana. Once you have enlightenment, you have confusion.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, they all come in pairs.
And I have in the appendix, you know, the notes to another book on the Heart Sutra, I have a list of 16 types of emptiness, if that's
the one. Did you get that?
But I'm not going to read it out loud now.
No, I typed it up. I was going to have it posted. Is that the same book?
Yeah.
Oh, that's
it's your book.
Cloud. Oh, yeah, the Ken of Cloud.
So basically, just, you know, so that's a way of basically short-circuiting this conversation.
Oh, Sandra, that's perfect.
Really ambiguous.
I will read it to you later.
I fear that we may not get to the point.
Yeah, let's get to this. We gotta get further on.
We actually do have time. So
we do.
The topic is no fear.
Good, let's hear this.
And instead of his language, we're gonna use the language which we're used to in our recitation. It's pretty close, but slightly different words. Therefore, Shariputra, since the bodhisattvas have no attainment, they abide by means of prajnaparamita. Since there is no obscuration of mind, there is no fear. There's two little sentences that go beyond it. They transcend falsity and attain complete nirvana. All the Buddhas of the three times, by means of prajnaparamita, fully awaken to unsurpassable, true, complete enlightenment. But here we are. The bodhisattvas have no attainment. They abide by means of prajnaparamita. Since there is no obscuration of mind, there is no fear. So, to begin with, Emily insisted that I have to define the two obscurations. And the two obscurations, in the traditional sense, are the klesha obscurations, that is the obscuration of emotional confusion in our being, which keeps us unsettled. And then the knowledge obscuration, which is the fundamental deep taking of things to be real. And that's very deep all the way, all our metaphysics and all our undiscussed and unmined assumptions of what reality is the knowledge obscuration. So there's two of them. And this is saying then that if the bodhisattva, or the bodhisattva can be taken to be any one of us at any given moment, if we go beyond our kleshas and settle into, go beyond our identification with anything as reality, then we settle into this, no fear.
Michael?
Yes.
When you say no obscuration of mind, does that mean both of those two?
Yes, it does. It would have to mean both. Let me see if this helps, if any of his language helps here. Carl?
What page are you on?
I'm on page 149, sorry. So he calls this the Vajra-like samadhi. It's not really an active effort of cutting through the last thread of the rope that binds us, but it is about settling within the nature of the mind as it is, without any expectations or fears. So it's almost that has to be it. Usually when we talk about a Vajra, it represents something very hard and indestructible. But there are two types of indestructibility. Vajra could be referred to the hardest substance possible, which cannot be destroyed by anything, but is the most powerful weapon that destroys everything else. However, the Vajra-like samadhi is indestructible because there's absolutely nothing in it that provides any chance for being attacked or destroyed. It is the final realization of both the factors to be relinquished and the remedies are equally non-existent. It is not just a concept or a fact, but that is what our mind is at that point. Reading further down, this is why it is indestructible. In Mahamudra terms, it means to rest in ordinary mind, or more precisely, it is not just resting in it, which is still somewhat dualistic, but it refers to mind being ordinary mind, mind being itself, mind being at home and free in its own space. Again, words, but does that give anyone any, did it hit anyone? I guess that's important. Not can you parse it, but.
Like mind resting as infinite space is how that strikes me.
Mm-hmm.
Well, actually, when we talk about this in terms of ordinary mind, it's fundamentally inconceivable. I mean, it's so present, it's so there, we can't take it apart. You know, we can't go in and yank out some kind of fragmentary description of it.
There's no fragment.
Exactly.
He says some more interesting things. Maybe in these modern times, the most essential message of the Heart Sutra is to say that bodhisattvas have no fear. This is the essential part of it. With people feeling separated from the world and other people, fear about everything seems to be the main problem in the world these days. Of course, there is fear about bad things, but there is also fear about good things, such as fear about love, and even fear about fear. There is literally nothing but that some people are not afraid of. So why is there no fear in bodhisattvas, in Buddhas? It corresponds to the statement in the low jump training that the supreme protection is emptiness. That's the one I was fishing for in New Supply. Yep. The more walls we try to build, or the more fending off techniques we try to employ, the more our fears increase, as we can witness so dramatically in many places in the world. No matter how high we build the walls and fences that keep people out, we just get more paranoid.
Whoa.
Well, that was prescient. That was prescient. Yeah. It seems that once the division between self and other has fallen away, then how could there be fear?
Well, that, I think it goes back to the earlier point of no self, no other.
Yeah. Yeah.
If there's no self in self and no self in other, there's no self at all, then there's no problem.
There's no problem and there's no fear. Nothing would be recognized as something other to be afraid of.
Right.
So then fear would not arise.
Well, and then we still have fear as a habit. Mm-hmm. So the issue at that point, in terms of our practice or meditation, is we encounter habit, which has nothing to do with anything that makes sense or doesn't make sense. That's why we continue practicing, because the habits are so deeply ingrained. They don't need to have an object. You know, when we talk about it this way, we're talking like we can go in there and see what's going on. Ah, fine. You know, except that the next day we're walking around and we're still going through our anxiety.
We're in the culture and we're bombarded by fear.
That's right.
And anxiety is a kind of a critical point. That is, our fear manifests as anxiety. Mm-hmm. If we really have no anxiety, then I suppose we're fearless.
And if you look at your meditation and notice how much you're in the past and how much you're in the future, I mean, all that leaves is the present, which is ding, ding, ding. That, you know, there's a lot of fear in there all the time, you know, like, oh, what if that happens? Or, you know, somehow, or you grasp on to, I really have to do that, and you make a list or whatever. I mean, it's all about closing down and shutting down the open possibility of even that 15-minute meditation. Yeah.
I know that, you know, since I just retired, I'm seeing the habit of, you know, that there's a certain amount of worry that is a constant and is looking for new things to attach to and is having to grow, you know, I can definitely feel that process of there's something I need to worry about, and unfortunately there's nothing I need to do today, and my health insurance forms are in, I don't work anymore, but here's something I can worry about on our Italian vacation.
There you go.
Yeah, but it really does feel like the same energy, exactly the same energy is there, and it's finding new objects.
Mm. Yeah.
So how many worry about relaxing?
How many decades do we still have dreams about not handing in our homework assignment, and therefore we didn't get our diploma?
Yeah. Although actually, I did have a transition. I went from a college dream to a cubicle dream. Yes. I remember looking and seeing that they can't really fit four people in one cubicle, can they?
I think it's cellular. I think it's down to that. I don't think it's just in our daily life. I mean, it's down to our molecules. It's down to being humans and bodies.
The fear.
Yes. Yeah. I think it's like...
Yeah.
Yeah, it's baseline.
Yeah, I think you're right. It's basically the part of us that's a small primate that's so worried about something swooping down on us.
You can realize
that I'm working, but I'm frustrated because I can't find what I need, and I haven't worked for a number of years.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And then I wake up and I go, how was that?
What really worries us, if you look at the numbers of our youth that are being diagnosed with anxiety.
You can see what value it is to have this path as a means to basically arrive, as it were, or simply recognize or realize fundamental nature of fearlessness and how that could be in itself a tremendous balm to this kind of current situation with so much frazzling and so much anxiety and so much...
But you could pull yourself out of this society, go to a mountain, be in a cave, and you'll find something to be freaked out about.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So it's not... I don't think it has to do with society. I think it has to do with being in a body.
The body is society.
But we're in a historical time that's full of fear.
The thing I would question in the book is the idea that this time is more fearful than previous ones. And I wouldn't go with that either.
We just know about that.
We're afraid of things that are a little further away than starving or the plague.
Indians lived in nature and it was great. They were killing each other constantly. Yeah. They were raiding each other, and they just lived down the street, through the woods. I don't know. It's all fantasy. Yeah.
But I agree with you, Mary, that biologically, almost we're afraid. That maybe because we're descendant.
But that's still intellectual to me. Yeah. We're in a body. And we have instincts to survive in our body. Well, we have to have clothes. We're think about the animals. Yes. They're on high alert all the time.
Yes.
They're either getting food or they're worried about
somebody else.
And I think we're the same in that way, just being in a form.
But thankfully, we can see that, though. And
we have the consciousness to work through that.
Right.
To find the egolessness through our practice.
Right.
Well, Tulku Chundrup, who some of you know, he's a local lama in Cambridge. He's wonderful. He's absolutely wonderful. He said very straightforwardly once, you have to have food, shelter, and clothing to practice Dharma. Mm-hmm. You can't really actually work on this project. You need the space and the support of those factors to make it possible, because otherwise you're too much consumed with those issues of survival.
Right.
We have to have those three elements. If we don't have those three elements, Dharma is extraordinarily difficult to actually accept or appreciate or understand. It just
so is society
doesn't apply.
Any person in society who doesn't have food, shelter, and clothing can't find the resources to become gentle and enlightened and loving.
Maybe. Some do.
Occasionally, but it's very difficult to be in that situation if you don't have the basic needs met.
I find it interesting that what you said is that when we leave for certain more immediate things, you reached into your past to bring up a fear. What was it?
I'm talking about dreams. When you have dreams and still occasionally have a dream that I didn't hand in a homework.
You went into the past or into your childhood to find the piece of anxiety.
The target, right.
I was thinking a fellow just died who was homeless, who was the most loved member of the community. And nobody ever saw him raise his voice. Mm-hmm. He was intoxicated. Nobody ever saw him be unkind. It was, he was remarkable. I don't know where it came from.
I think there's outliers, without a doubt.
Yeah, he was.
But I don't think really it's fair to take that example and say everyone else who's in that situation should be like that.
No, I wasn't saying that. You were saying that's impossible. That's not what I'm saying.
Yeah.
But I'm saying there was, you know, this person who.
I think you should let Roberta's statement be as it is.
Yeah.
Let it lie.
Okay. Yeah.
What else do we have to say about fear? Fearless.
I think Mary had a really important point, that there's sort of this biological fear, but there's also another, there are layers of fear that we add on to that, which are, you know, worries about the future or what we did in the past or whatever. And maybe they're related, I'm not sure. But I think that we can work on the latter. We may not
I think you're talking about instinctual fear when you talk about, like, when you mention this notion of just it may have hard wiring. And so... Obviously, we have a lot of privileges we enjoy and totally take for granted that if they're gone, you know, suddenly we're in a very different state. There are ways to work on that level. And there certainly are practices to help support that journey. We're talking about our intellectual and conceptual level of somehow clearing out, deconstructing and settling, learning how to tame and train our minds. And then we have to go into some kind of body dimension to be able to deal with those instinctual fears, which, you know, are just inbuilt. And they're not like they have to be, actually, it's not like we're not supposed to have them.
Right.
You know, maybe they actually have, it's a form of intelligence, and we don't need to feel like we have to eradicate them necessarily. Because they're just simply helpful for us to learn how to take care of ourselves. It doesn't mean that we have to get rid of everything that's actually providing information that we use to function properly or, you know, manage. So that's an interesting point.
But observing them as you're sitting with it.
Yeah,
yes.
And watching yourself react and watching yourself through that process is another layer of body life.
Mm-hmm. So it seems to me that the fact that we see, that we have the critical intelligence of seeing our situation is itself very two-edged. It can get us into terrible trouble, and it can move us towards enlightenment. And we have this because we're humans with leisure to think.
Yes. So, I think sometimes we talk in this class very often about groundlessness, and I think we're also lucky in this room because there are people in this world who are truly groundless. They don't have places to live. They're on foot. They don't have food. They're in fear. Mm-hmm. And that's groundless.
Mm-hmm.
You know, having the luxury to sit and meditate and contemplate groundlessness is completely different.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think there's a whole, the sort of, all that discussion of the precious human birth and all the other ancillary conditions, basically, that in addition to being born as a human in a time when there's the Dharma and then all the, just all, you know, basically having enough, you know, comfort and leisure to be
born
able to have.
Rest and work.
Yeah.
And safety.
I get messages reminding me of that every day from Amnesty International.
What about fear of death or mortality?
Ah.
Good one.
Good.
Are you afraid of death or of dying?
I'm afraid of pain. I'm not afraid of dying so much as I'm afraid of pain, but I'm curious about the unknown, so that kind of offsets, you know, I'm curious about it, so that it offsets the fear of it. In a way, and maybe that's true for all fears, that if you can be curious about it or even learn something about it, that you can
transcend it that way. Ask me on my deathbed, and I'll tell you.
You may be too late.
That's the same thing about, it's how am I going to die? That's the fear part, you know. Yeah. I mean, let me get run over by a truck, I'll be fine. But I mean, the contemplating being very ill,
yes,
and what illness does and how difficult it is. Yeah. And
the suffering.
If you've ever been with someone who was ill on the long term, it's not something one looks forward to. So if there's a fear there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Fear of dementia.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, certainly a lot of atheists are very cheerful in, you know, at the end of their life, because they're very certain that this is it, and that you know, that death will be the end. So having an absence of spirituality is sometimes actually a help for some of these issues.
I find that hard. I believe in spirituality, you know, so that's something that I'm comfortable, you know, I'm not scared of death on that level. But how, as I age and as I see friends die,
oh, yeah,
I become more fearful about the way I'm going out of this world, because none of us are hanging around.
And that's a hard fear to get a handle on, right?
Yes.
I think that's, you know, it's one thing to be afraid of something concrete, and it's another to be afraid of something that's so vague and so pervasive.
Yeah. Okay.
And inevitable.
Yeah.
Speaking of someone who's going to a vigil right after this class.
One of your clients?
One of my patients has begun transitioning.
Megan works in hospice.
Okay.
I think that the fact that we've removed death and the dying process from our homes adds to that. When you grow up in a culture where there is dying in the home you live in from the time you were born, it normalizes it. And it becomes less fearful and more of a fact of life / death.
Also,
we don't slaughter the animals we eat.
No.
There's just there's such a cleansing of death and a compartmentalization of it, that I think that really does add to a lot of people's anxiety around it. Anxiety combined with ignoring it, like saying, that's not going to happen to me.
I think that working with hospice is an incredible, incredible thing, because I have a personal experience with my daughter. Last year, we had home hospice, and then she went into Kaplan Family Hospice. And we were there for 3 weeks.
That's my organization.
And that is a very peaceful, wonderful way to leave the world, because there's so much support and comfort there.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a very small amount of people who get
it
that.
Is. You're right.
And it should be.
I agree.
Even home hospice is horrendous. I mean, when you're the caregiver and you're on 24/7, there's people coming, but you're on.
Yeah.
And then when you can go to the hospice and you get all that support and care, it's a sanctuary for both the dying and the caregiver.
Mm-hmm.
You get to be...
We're building another house right here in Walden,
yes,
by the way.
Yes.
Yeah.
I got the brochure from Her Dimensions today. But there should be much more of that.
I agree.
And there should
Without
be more... it should be easier to get in and stay there.
Yep.
And that's you know, when you can get there, it's incredible.
I'm thankful you're able to have that experience.
Oh, we felt blessed. We did. It was. I got to be the mom.
Yeah. Right.
And that was great.
That's exactly
we
right.
We had all kinds of time to talk and share, and it was beautiful.
Mm.
You had a tougher job, trust me.
One of the sort of fundamental things to my way of thinking about death and dying is the fundamental question, what or who is it that is dying?
Mm-hmm.
What is, and it's back to the whole question, what is the self? It's the sense of self And back to the question of ego and egolessness. If I feel that I am this body mind, and I'm contained within this boundary, then I'm going to have certain feelings about the end of this. If I understand that the I that I take myself to be is infinitely larger than that, without boundaries and outside of time, then with that understanding, there's no longer the perception that I will die, because at that point I know myself to be uncreated, unborn, indestructible, essentially, and just infinitely larger. So the body mind that is the expression of that, mm-hmm. in this lifetime, it was born, it has a trajectory through life, and it passes away. But that doesn't say anything about the actual much larger self that with realization I understand myself to be. I'm not saying, by the way, that I actually do understand this, but that's my take on it, and there are glimpses of that at times.
Well, that's kind of a Hindu thing too, you know. I mean, they talk about self.
It's also Buddha nature.
Yeah.
Well, Buddha nature is fundamentally beyond kind of what we would posit as a self, because there's no reference point to it. I think that's an important distinction.
Okay.
We use this word self. I mean, Hindus do it all the time, and, you know, they don't have any problem, but then you've got God everywhere. You know,
I don't think that's what he was saying. Go ahead. Let's say
I do think that one thing I get a little bit concerned about is that I want to make a case for not knowing as a viewpoint here, rather than, you know, whether you come from a traditional Buddhist culture and you have a strong belief in reincarnation, or if you have a belief in, you know, just I would like to not have to. You know, to be open to just not knowing what occurs at the moment of death and after death, and not have to, you know, that I should be, it seems like you should be able to just accept that you don't know what the next step is going to be, which is actually true for everything in your life, and that's a viewpoint that I want to hold on to. I worry about creating too large a frame, you know, an intellectual framework of the which, and then depending on that, and I you know, at the and I'm not sure I want to rely on that at the moment of death.
Also, bear in mind that this experience, when it happens to us, is going to be so visceral, not any theory.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. It's good.
Right.
And we don't know how that is and how, what it would be like and how it happens, except that it happens and it's not a theory. It's...
Yeah.
It's, to me, it's like the best preparation to me is the gap at the end of the out-breath. That... If you don't take a breath in, that's it, right? And that gap is our chance to sort of experience that open space. And the other thing is, I would say that, I mean, I don't know if this is universal, but my understanding is Buddhists don't believe in reincarnation, because that's carne, meat, or body is in there, but the word rebirth, I think, is more accurate.
Yeah, rebirth has to do with what really it reincarnates, and when you talk about what reincarnates,
body,
you're talking about
and your old, you're yourself,
about skandhas and ayatanas. You're talking about the factors that, you know, make up our so-called identity, right? When we actually look at those factors, those are what reincarnate. So as we sort of like are able to clarify that those are factors that that are employed in our experience, are factors of experience. we're moving towards something else which is more closer to something like awareness. I mean, I think if the training for death is really about awareness, that awareness is the point in terms of, and I do believe, frankly, and so, just one moment, please.
I really have to get going, sorry.
Okay. Is, you know, one of the reasons of Dharma practice is to prepare for death. Not as a big deal, but recognizing it as fundamentally something that, you know, is inevitable, and we want to work with it, and we want to be able to come to terms with that process. So that actually...
Do you want to see practice?
I think we really have to end at this point. What time is it? Because it's time.
What time is it?
It's after. It's
9:05 in at this point.
Yes,
mindful of our fear and our fearlessness and what we don't know, and could we call it quits for tonight?